Great fun. I'm telling them, some of these inquiries are surely lunatic, and some are very interesting. But a year or two ago, I did start getting a sort of crop of correspondence. It got to be fun. And some letters came which I would never have expected to receive. Others I started to dread receiving. It has gone a bit further than in this piece which I wrote about it. There was a fine moment when my colleague, Professor of American Literature, went all the way to Brussels, as he thought, to give a paper, came back saying, "Somebody handed me this letter for you, and I have just picked out of my own pigeonhole a letter with an inquiry of this kind from a young woman in Brussels who had also, to make double sure, got her own supervisor to hand to my colleague during his visit to Brussels an identical letter just in case the postal system didn't work." So within 5 minutes I got two copies of this letter. My colleague said, "God, I feel like a character out of Kurt Vonnegut," the little guy who goes through the planet saying hello. Anyway, there's a fate in all of this, and there's also a little sort of piece of writing attached. It's called Paraphrases. And the letters. "Dear Mr. Fisher, I am writing a thesis on your work, but I'm unable to obtain texts. I have articles by David D. and Mottram E., but not your books, since booksellers I have approached refuse to take my order, saying they can no longer afford to handle this type of business. It is too late for me to change my subject to the work of a more popular writer. So please, Mr. Fisher, you must help me, since I face the alternatives of failing my degree or repaying the whole of my scholarship money. Dear Mr. Fisher, although I've been unable to read much of your work, to get it, that is, I am a great admirer of it, and your landscapes have become so real to me, I'm convinced I have, in fact, become you. I have never, however, seen any photograph of you, and am most curious to have an idea of your appearance, beyond what my mirror, of course, tells me. The cover of your collected poems, reproduced in The Guardian, November 1971, shows upwards of 50 faces. But which is yours? Are you the little boy at the front? And if so, have you changed much since then?" Next one's from a lady and has replied, "Dear Mr. Fisher, recently while studying selections from a modern anthology with one of my GCE groups, I came across your interest in the title Starting to Make a Tree. After the discussion, I felt strongly you were very definitely holding something back in this poem, though I can't quite reach it. Are you often in Rugby? If you are, perhaps we could meet and I could try at least to explain. Cordially, Avis Tree. P.S. Should we arrange a rendezvous, I'm afraid I wouldn't know who to look out for, as I've never unfortunately seen your photograph, but I notice you were born in 1930, the same year as Ted Hughes. Would I be right in expecting you to resemble him more or less?" "Dear Miss Tree, it's true I'm in Rugby quite often, but the train goes through without stopping. Could you fancy standing outside the up refreshment room a few times so that I could learn to recognise you? If you could just get hold of my four books and wave them, then I'd know it was you. As for my own appearance, I suppose it inclines more to the Philip Larkin side of Ted Hughes's looks. See if you think so as I go by. Dear Mr. Fisher, I've been commissioned to write a short critical book on your work. But find that all... This is true. I've been commissioned to write a short critical book on your work. But find that although I have a full dossier of reviews, etc., I don't have access to your books. Libraries over here seem just not to have brought them in. Since the books are quite a few years old now, I imagine they'll all have been remanded some while back. Or worse, pulped. So can you advise me on locating second-hand copies? Not too expensively, I hope. Anyway, yours with apologies and respect. Dear Mr. Fisher, I am now so certain I'm you that it's obvious to me that the collection of poems I'm currently working on must be your own next book. Can you let me know who is to publish it? And exactly when it will be appearing? I shouldn't like there to be any trouble over contracts, plagiarism, etc. besides which it would be a pity to think one of us was wasting time and effort. How far have you got? Please help me. I do think this is urgent. It didn't stop there. The delightful thing was that a day or two after I read that at the National Poetry Centre a year or so ago, I had a rather plaintive letter from the man to whom the printed version of the poem is dedicated, saying, "Dear Mr. Fisher, you know, this is a very embarrassing letter for me to write, since I do have copies of your work, and I'm not writing a thesis about you, but I am writing a thesis about something very connected, and will you answer these questions?" So he got dedicated, and he accepted the dedication very carefully. I thought he might have been a bit more grateful. Anyway, another one about the literary life. This is one that dates from the, if it exists, that dates from the sort of narrows, excuse me, of poetry reviewing in the 1960s, you know, when the Review and the Times, the Free Supplement and Sunday Times, had a very narrow little chasm within which one, often, or two, or one and a half under pseudonyms, reviewers were just bashing at anything that came through in what they called a fun spirit. And one or two people got damaged. Not me, I haven't published anything, and by the time I published any books, they'd stopped reviewing them. So this is not written from personal acrimony. It's a poem called Making of the Book, and in it you're to suppose that a fairly worldly man of letters of this sort is advising a young writer on how to get his book through the rapids so that he isn't actually torn apart. Lovers of literature will know this. Couple of quotations from Chaucer towards the end. The Making of the Book. Let the blurb be strong, modest and true. Build it to take a belting. They'll pick on that. Then choose your second gang. The first, led by your publisher, you already belong to. Its membership involuntary, it's free. For the other, set up an interesting tension between the acknowledgements and the resemblances. But in the photograph, keep the cut of your moustache equivocal. Write your own warrant. Make plain in idiot-sized letters for which of the others you'll take the blame. Yes, it's necessary to belong. Several allegiances are laid out for you ready. And remember, though you're only a poet, there's somebody, somewhere, whose patience it falls to you finally to exhaust. For poetry, we have to take it, is essential, though menial, its purpose constantly to set up little enmities. For faction makes a reciprocal to and fro of the simplest sort, and characterless but for an aesthetic variable, inaudible to all but the players. And this little mindless motion, that nobody but the selfless and schooled for service would ever stoop to, drives the society. It's a long story, but the minuscule dialectic, tick-tacking away no more than notional in obscure columns, at length transmits itself mysteriously through education, which pays off the poets too, one way or another, out beyond government, past control and commodity, even to the hollowness of the 17th percentile, the outermost reaches of the responsible. If the reviewers fall idle, everybody drops dead. It's as simple as that. Go, little book. And just because it's on the page before, a little poem called Poem. When I started writing in the late 40s, early 50s, there was a sort of neo-romanticism, rather stale in currency. And the magazines you could buy then were full of poems called Poem. And I was enormously impressed by the aplomb with which people could do this. I could never remember anything that followed that title. It just blurred my consciousness completely. And I said, when I grew up and wrote books, I would write a poem called Poem. So in the end I did. And it's rather nice. I've just had a set of poems translated into Dutch, and the copy arrived a week or two ago. And I don't know that at all, except that it's obviously very close to us. Is there a Dutchman in the house? No? Should have been provided. Lovely, lovely language for being close to English. There's a line in the poem, "Here is your photograph." And I identified the poem, which it was, by suddenly coming on the line that says, "Here is your photo." Poem. The small poem, the unit of feeling. Pretty red mouth, blotted and asking why. Here is your photograph. It is a square view of the air of things. One certain hour. When, just in the background, a green engine goes mad in a tree. To the end of time, pretty mouth. Another little poem called "White Cloud, White Blossom." Sandy wall and trees locked to the sky. Small country, buckled iron fences ducking in the grass. Leaf print shadow, fingers on a big soft belly out in the sun. Old bricks patch the mud hole where cows come through the hedge. Dead swags of bramble shake on the wire. Under the elders, dry twig beds lie. Steam from a mash boiler blowing down through the wood. White cloud, white blossom. One or two rather more recent ones. I'm supposed to be an urban poet, I think, because I was raised in Birmingham and wrote about 20 years ago a lot of stuff about urban landscape. And I don't know, not all my work is like that. Occasionally, a little bit of country seeps through. And I read a poem called "Staffordshire Red." I live in the north of Staffordshire, you know, in the Potteries. And there's a sort of miniature countryside around it, very inconsequential, very variable. And I had a rather curious paraliterary experience once a few years ago when I was exploring near where I live, a place I didn't know at all, on a day with no sun, sort of day where you can't tell whereabouts in the compass you are, unless you're a much better countryman than I am. And I was driving a car, and I'm quite used to the idea that everybody's imagination is unlike mine. I'll do another piece about this. But I had the rather uncomfortable experience of realising I'd taken a turn in the road, and I was driving straight through a poem by Geoffrey Hill. And I get all right with Geoffrey Hill, but I wouldn't particularly like to inhabit his imagination. There's a sort of eeriness about it. But he comes from very near to where I come from. And if you look at the Mercy in Him, there's an evocation of gashed red sandstone and ferns and sort of wet sandstone landscape, which is certainly part of my mental environment. And I found I was going through this and wrote him a poem about it. What it was a road just diving down quite artificially through a cleft wet sandstone, and a green light arrangement through leaves and trees and so forth overhead, full of atmosphere, and the sort of thing where the atmosphere is so strong you think, oh crikey, this is much too artistic, whatever happened to inadvertent effects. And it's called "Staffordshire Red." Another sort of bee in my bonnet is that it's rather nice to write about sandstone. If you're writing about stone, there's a rather nice chapter about me in a book by Donald Davey called, what's it called? Thomas Hardy. It was meant to be called The Politics of English Poetry, but the American publishers wouldn't let him say that. So it's Thomas Hardy in British Poetry. And a sort of obituary thing about me in that book, in which Donald Davey says, with some wonderment, being a Yorkshireman, he goes through some of my old city stuff. Am I reading enough poetry? Goes through some of my own old city stuff, which is largely about some sodden brickwork and the plaster that's been teamed on and things of this sort. And Donald Davey said a big thing about stone and solidity and Adrian Stokes and all this sort of thing. And he said, if there is stone in Fisher's poetry, it is certainly not limestone. The building materials are chiefly pea-stained brick and things like that. But in fact, if there's any stone where I come from, it's wet and red pine. Staffordshire Red. There are still clefts cut in the earth to receive us living. The turn in the road, sheer through the sandstone at Offley, caught me unawares and drew me, car and all, down in the rock, closed overhead with trees that arched from the walls, their watery green lighting ferns and moss shade. I had not been looking for the passage, only for the way, but being suddenly in, was drawn through slowly, altering by an age, altering again. And then the road dropped me out into a small, well-wooded valley in vacancy. Behind me was a nondescript cleft in the trees. It was still the same sunless afternoon. No north or south anywhere in the sky. By side roads, I made my way out and round again, across the mildnesses of Staffordshire, where the world changes with every mile and never says so. When I came face to face with the entry, I passed myself through a second time to see how it was. It was as it had been. The savage cut in the red ridge, the turn in the traveller's bowels, by design, ancient or not. The brush flick of energy between earth and belly, the evenness of it. How hard is understanding? Some things are lying in wait in the world, walking about in the world, happening when touched as they must. On that same theme, I'll read another poem about two other pieces, one about walking into somebody else's imagination, a very old poem, 20 years or more, called, I've forgotten, The Intruder. And you'll see the story of this. As I think of yellow, a deep shining yellow, that plunges down with white enfolding it. And as I think of a certain stretch of roadway, with a small river beside it in a stone-built channel, I see, quite clearly, a young girl, black-haired and quiet, doing some household work a couple of generations ago. Her face is broad, like a filbert. The features small. I can see where the colours lie on her skin. I can see plainly through the brown varnish sentiment lays on the scene, the fat lips and the inexpressive eyes. A dark body scent disturbs the air, but not enough to persuade me that she and I might sympathise. She means so little to me, one way or another. She means so little to me, one way or the other. Yet seems so real. It's as if I'd walked into somebody else's imagination. But who? None of my friends, I think. And what will come of it? what way shall I be involved? The wisest thing seems to be by way of the road with the little river and the deep shining yellow, to retire discreetly and leave the sulky bitch to it. The other one on a similar theme. Very well, Donald Daly keeps popping up. He read that poem and said, Hardy wouldn't have got out, he would have stayed. And of the next one, he would have imagined that sort of girl. But the next one is called The Memorial Fountain, and by some eerie thing, just as my colleague was a character in a story by Kurt Vonnegut, I think I'm a character in a story by Donald Daly. There's a book by Daly called Ezra Pound, Poet and Sculptor, which I read when it first came out, and was interested in his things about realism and Pound's way of hard notation of scenes when he travels to draw a scene. But Pound's interest in hard, clear notation in the canvas. And I did an exercise, a thing which presented itself to me, which was a scene in the middle of Birmingham as it then was, and unless you're much older than most of you are, you just wouldn't find that. But the middle of Birmingham, where the library now is, used to be composed of in a tiny area, not much bigger than this room it seemed, composed of an incredible variety of derivative, eclectic Victorian architecture. There's a town hall, which is an imitation of a Roman imitation of a Greek temple. There was a neoclassic library with a portico. There was a Gothic fountain in memory of Joseph Chamberlain with a cloverleaf basin around it. That's still there. There were statues, everything. A sort of vulgar forest of sculpture with the odd lime tree and so forth, plane tree rather. And I was there one cold summer sunset when the effects of light and architecture were lurid and hard. And as it were, if they'd been art, they would have been bad art. But they're reality and very final. And my poem was an attempt to draw this, not as a piece of building up atmosphere, but a piece of hard notation, and then considering it. This is a poem, 12 years old. I mention that because the poet is obviously younger than I am now. The Memorial Fountain. The fountain plays through summer dusk in gaunt shadows, black constructions against a late clear sky, water in the basin where the column forms, shaky, rapid and wild, in cross waves, in back waves, the light glinting in blue as in a wind, though there is none, harsh skyline, far off scaffolding bitten against the air. Somber mood in the presence of things, no matter what things, respectful sepia. This scene, people on the public seats, embedded in it, darkening intelligences of what's visible, private, given over, all of them. Many scenes, still somber. As for the fountain, nothing in the describing beyond what shows for anyone. Above all, no atmosphere. It's like this often. I don't exaggerate. And the scene? A 35-year-old man, poet, by temper, realist, watching a fountain. And the figures round it, in garish twilight, working to distinguish an event from an opinion. This man, intent, uncomfortable, romantic notion. little pieces with an adjective in them.
That's simple.
Anyway, sometimes a word, a piece, loses its surface identity and becomes a very strange stimulus. I just wrote a little collection of items called The Dirty Dozen. From a phrase of my own, I just found I'd mentioned, I'd called nature dirty in a poem. So I just went on. The Dirty Dozen. Dirty nature. Dirty sea. Dirty daytime. Dirty crowd. Dirty melody. Dirty heart. Dirty God. Dirty surprise. Dirty drumming. Dirty design. Dirty radium. Dirty joke. Another one about the literary life, or some part of it. I'm very fond of the translator Eadie's, not in its ridiculous aspect, but I've always been rather fascinated, although a bit guilty, in the light of one's literary education, about the way in which a lot of the poetry I've read, and I'm no linguist, which has appealed to me for one reason or another, has not been in my own language, or even American, but has been in some, well, it's been translated into English from ideas which were German or Russian or Spanish. And I've also had the feeling that a fair bit of imaginative stimulus is coming to me through translated poetry, and in spite of the fact that I know perfectly well that an enormous amount of nuance and accuracy and tone is being lost in the translation. So I feel part of my pleasure in that sort of thing is sidestepping some of the issues of language, but I like it. And I wrote a little poem dedicated to Michael Hamburger, who, as you know, has been tirelessly translating and presenting German, particularly. And it's just a little poem called Style. Style? I couldn't begin. That marriage, like a supple glove that won't suffer me to breathe, to the language of one's time and class, the languages of my time and classes, those intricacies of self and sign, the power to mimic and be myself, I couldn't. I'd rather reach the air as a version by my friend Michael. He knows good Englishes, and he knows the language gets my poems out of. All very platonic. I read a quite recent piece called The Trace. This is a poem which is about a trace, just the concept of something which goes on through various... It's a changes poem. It's not very long, but the idea of a continuity, a set of changes going through all sorts of materials. It's really just an act of attention or a little spylight going through various images. The Trace. Although at first it was single and silver, it travelled as ink falls through cold water and gleamed in a vein out of the darkness that turned suddenly on its back and was dusty instead, letting go forth, as it must, a plummet of red wax, from whose course, when they lost it, rings of dull steel, like snake ribs in a sidelong curve, twisted away and lifted, to clamp onto a concrete precipice broken with rust and with shrubby growths clustering under it, their leaves shading and silvering in the currents of light draining among the branches to where it was sodden, full of silky swallowed hair that dried and was flying in a fan, air flickering from its ends, collecting silvers as it twined itself into the gauze, then scattered as many mercurial boats all through the chamber, darting everywhere, in under the roof keel, with its infinite brown decline, its warp unmistakable as it reached down into the daylight, with a sidelong wooden nose, biased like the set of a rudder, and pulling in everything that could raise a bright wave against it, making colours print themselves onto planes with the effort, one plate of red enamel, dominant and persisting, even through a grey sleep that scored its face, running away as water welling downwards, through a raised, irregular, static vein, moving only by rills within itself. Let's see, I want to read the sequence. Not for a moment suggesting that your attention is less than what's the word? Sterling, stout, or whatever. Meditate, it's an easy sequence. It hasn't got any marvellous architectonic and thing. But before I read the sequence, I read just a single piece, for the reason that it is enshrined in a poster poem which are published by the Light Organisation called Westminster and Art. You're selling my book, okay. While we're hustling, there's that there with Westminster and Art, the chairman of the literature panel, and his assistant officer, myself and Mr. Merchant, would be delighted if you help the copy by buying a poster. As to the availability of my work, it is in fact marvellously unavailable. The books are all out of print. What is in print, due to the munificence of Westminster's Arts, is this pamphlet, which I read from in a bit anyway, called 19 Poems and an Interview. The interview is with a marvellous young man called Jed Rattler, from 1106, or used to be, come from 1168 Woodcrest Avenue, Mechanicsburg, Pennsylvania. And I didn't believe he was real, but he turned up and used my tape recorder. At least something used my tape recorder, and the interview was done, and it's in there. there are some of those available at 70p, and oh, there's a book or two. Anyway, that's all, pretty well all there is, yet, until later in the year. The poem that's on the poster poem, the artwork of which is done by a local man called David Prentice, who lives a few miles down the road in Helidon, is called On the Open Side. On the open side, look out for sun patches of sea blue. If you see them, it's beginning to shift, with factory towers along the edge, chalk white and silver, empty even of machines. The other life, the endless other life, endless beyond the beginning, that holds and suddenly presents a sunny day 20 years ago. The open window of a train held up on an embankment for an hour. Down the field there were children playing, round a concrete garage. That was all. Something the other life wanted. I hadn't kept it. But look out for the sea blue patches. They'll not make problems. Now the sequence is sequence of the simplest sort, i.e. it's a set of small pieces which are not freestanding, are not, as it were, the small poem, but they are just little pieces which lean together to to support one another, and they were written in sequence. They're called diversions, and that is just what they are, as they might be in music, just divertissement, things which may be coming in at all directions, not particularly being conclusive. Some of them are narrative, some of them are just exclamations, but they have some sort of sequentiality for me, in that they did come to mind in the sequence in which they're written, and I just have to be a bit mulish or agnostic about them and say, well, that's how they fell out, that's where they lie, and here they are. But you know, just as they go, there are 20 of them. Don't, as it were, expect them to build up into a narrative or to refer back among themselves. They're just at their seat. Diversion. One. Trouble coming on a Saturday or a Monday, some day with a name to it. Staining the old paths trouble knows, though I forget them. Two. Walk through, minding the nettles at the corner of the brick path. Don't feel sorry for language, it doesn't bear talking about. Three. Built for quoting in a tight corner. The power of dead imaginings to return. Four. Just beside my track through the dark. My own dark, not to be described. The screech owl sounds in his proper cry and in all his veritable image. You would know him at once. Beyond him, a dissolution of my darkness into such forms as live there in the space beyond the clear image of an owl. Forms without image, pointless to describe. Five. I saw what there was to write, and I wrote it. When it felt what I was doing, it lay down and died under me. Six. Grey weather. Sorry, six. Grey weather beating across the uplands. And the weather matters. Grey weather beating easily across the uplands. Seven. Crooked angle wings blown sideways against the edge of the picture. Eight. Roused from a double depth of sleep, looking up through a hole in the sleep surface above. No sense of what's there. A luminous dial weaves along the dark like a torch. There's somebody already up and about. A touch paper crackle to their whispering. Nine is about kites, not the birds, the flying toys, or objects. The kites are the best sort of gods, mindless, but all style. Even their capriciousness, however dominant, not theirs at all. Lost from its line, one flies steadily out to sea, its printed, imperturbable face glinting as it dips and rises, dwindling over the waves. The crowd on the shore reach out their hearts. Ten. Leaden August, with the life gone out of it. Not enough motion to shift old, used-up things. A bad time to be rid of troubles. They roll back in. Dead troubles take longer than live ones. 11. The pilgrim disposition. Walking in strung-out crowds on exposed trackways, as if 10 yards from home. Domestic to-ing and fro-ing, uncoiled and elongated in a dream of purpose. 12. Then, some calm and formal portrait to turn a level gaze on the milling notions. Its tawniness of skin denoting tension, maybe, a controlled palate, or a blush of self-delight welling softly from its intelligence. 13. Very pushed in. 13. Periodicity. The crack under the door of this room, as I stare at it late at night, has the same relation to its field as what? The corner over the curtain rail in a room I was in one night 40 years ago and more. The light and the height are different, and so am I. But something in the staring comes round again. So I stare at the single recurrence of a canter I expect never to meet. The next one has the Latin name of the plant, Crassula arborescens, very familiar, the tiny succulent that you're bound to have seen. Sliding the tongue-leaved Crassula arborescens smartly in its pot and saucer from one end of the windowsill right down to the other alters the frame view, much as a louver chutter would. All my life I've been left-handed. Next one's for musicians. 15. Here comes the modulation. Elbows in. Tighten up, a sucked-in, menacing sound, but full. The space is narrow, the time marked out, and everybody's watching. 16. The woman across the lane stoops, hands on knees, behind that, black and grey hair falling forward, her nose level with the top of a 4-foot wall, under a huge, shaggy bank of privet. Nose to nose with her across a saucer, his tail lifting into the privet shadow, a big dark cat with a man's face marked out in white. Quietly, in a good, firm Scottish voice, set well down, she tells his story. How, when his owners first moved another cat in on him, then moved out altogether, he ran wild for 3 years, haunting back once in a while, a frightener. After that, for 1.5 years, she'd set for him daily, slowly drawing him in as near as this. She didn't expect more. She talks, and the cat drinks. He turns his mask to me, sees me, and without pausing vanishes. Later, from a distance, I see the two of them again, a saucer apart. The cat, with his enormous guilt and importance. The fortunate cat, to have such a calm Scots lady to understand his importance. 17. Out to one side, a flight of shops turning towards the sun. Each one a shallow step higher, white and new and good. And there's the ultimate in shops, the gallery. Somebody can be stood, can elect to stand, in fresh clothes but barefoot, on a slate ledge, in the place of a pot. Fastidious, beyond the flakings of the skin, the vegetable variants of body form, the negative body aura, that shadowy khaki coat, can stand and receive attributions of pain and excellence. The next one, 18, starts with a quotation from the exhibition material in an industrial museum, a pattern maker shop. Excuse me. Everything cast in iron must first be made in wood. foundry pattern maker, shapes, drones, gears, furnace doors, coupling in yellow pine. His work fulfills the conditions for myth. It celebrates origin. It fixes forms for endless recurrence. It relates energy to form. Is useless in itself. For all these reasons, it also attracts aesthetic responses in anybody free to respond aesthetically. And it can be thought with. Arranged on trays in the Industrial Museum, it mimes the comportment of the gods in the ethnology cases. 19. Outlines start to appear on the milky surface. Points first, quickening into perimeters, branches and dividers, an accelerating wonder. Arrest. Try lifting it away before the creation diversifies totally to a deadlock fission, diamond faceted house bricks in less than life. The thin trace lifted off will drop into a new medium and dissolve. On the bland surface will appear new outlines. Both these ways are in nature. And the next pose, the last one, is meant to be a set of layers. It's a landscape seen through a window, which is layered down just like a painting. A world arranged in zones, outside and into this waterfront cafe. A strip of sky, misty with light. A deep band of dark, hazy mountainside. A whole estuary with foreshortened almost to nothing. A quay, a full harbour, then a pavement, a sill, the table where I sit, and the darkness in my head. Everything still along its level, except the middle zone, the harbour water, turbulent with the sunlight, even in calm air. That's the sequence. I'll read one or two from this pamphlet, and having occupied you for now, I'll probably break off then. I'll keep a couple that I'd like to finish with, and if anybody wants to chat around anything before that, maybe that would be a point that could happen. So I'll read a couple of pieces from this pamphlet. Poem about visuals, really. The idea of, you know, white on white, dark on dark, that sort of painting where the whole thing is in the concept of two identical tones superimposed one on another, Just a little piece. Dark on dark. Dark on dark. They never merge. The eye imagines to separate them. Imagines to make them one. Imagines the notion of impossibility for eyes. It is writing. Because it could do it well, the poem wants to glorify suffering. I mistrust it. I mistrust the poem in its hour of success, a thing capable of being tempted by ethics into the wonderful. And what exists quite, what takes up quite a part of this pamphlet is a large part of a sequence I've written called Hands with Liberties. Hands with where I come from. And I really had the most claustrophobic childhood there, although I didn't know at the time. We just never left it. You know, stayed there day after day, and I thought that was the world, year after year. And later, and maybe I'll finish my whole reading with one or two of those pieces, I wrote a sequence called City, which is 20 years ago, very much about Birmingham, at the time of Reconstruction, when my own childhood associations, which were terrifically strong and sensual, were being churned up before my eyes when I returned to the place. A lot of quite straightforward topographical and documentary writing there, but some of those images from childhood are so obsessive with me that they come up unavoidably like fetishes whenever I hear certain music, whenever I think certain thoughts. And I wrote a sequence of rather more abstractive poems quite recently in which I was trying to, in fact I think I succeeded, to exorcise these by simply looking hard at these images, these little street corners, bits of old tree, bits of fence, bits of laundry boilers, and treating them as dummy, as things to meditate on. So the Hands with Liberties are a set of things where I take a little thing that's familiar, mental furniture for me, and say, hey, wait a minute, I'm going to get you, I'm going to draw you and hold you. And maybe you can listen to one or two of those. Something has to happen here. There must be change. It's the place from which the old world fell away, leaning in its dark hollow. We can go down there, into the seepage, the cottage garden with hostas in the chimney pot, or somewhere here, in the crowd of exchanges, we can change. At the end of the familiar, throwing away the end of the first energy regardless. Nothing for getting home with. If there's more, it rises from under the first step into the strange and under the next and goes on lifting up all the way. Nothing has a history. The most gnarled things are all new. Mercurial tongues dart in at the mouth, in at the ears. They lick at the joints. It is new, this moon sweat, or by day, this walking through groundsel, among cracked concrete foundations, with devil dung in the corners. Newest of all, the loading platform of a wrecked dairy, departure point for a further journey into the strangest yet. Getting home somehow, late, late. And small. And this is what I will finish with for the moment. A very obvious, heavy industrial landscape. No dark in the body, deep as this. Even though the sun hardens the upper world, a ladder climbs down under the side in the shadow of the tank and crosses tarry pools. There are metals that burn the air, a deathly blue stain in the cinder ballast. And out there past the shade, sunlit rust hangs on the still water. Deep as we go into the stink, this is not the base, not the ground. This is the entertainment.